Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Since the chilling images of torture at Abu Ghraib prison first became public, there's been a slew of investigations and reports, but so far only one person convicted, and no one at the Pentagon has lost their job. The latest report came today from the Schlesinger panel, and despite being appointed by Donald Rumsfeld, it found that there were leadership failures in Washington. James Schlesinger, who served as Secretary of Defense for Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, headed the panel, and he spoke today at a Washington press conference.
The discussion whether or not this was just a few individuals in Abu Ghraib, this was not just a few individuals. They were unique in the sense that there was sadism on the night shift at Abu Ghraib, sadism that was certainly not authorized. It was kind of animal house on the night shift. That is reflected in the fact that there was no such activities during the day shift when there were different non-coms in charge. There was direct responsibility for those activities on the part of the commanders on the scene, up to the brigade level, because they did not adequately supervise what was going on at Abu Ghraib. In addition, there was indirect responsibility at higher levels in that the weaknesses at Abu Ghraib were well known and that corrective action could have been taken and should have been taken. We believe that there is institutional and personal responsibility right up the chain of command as far as Washington is concerned.
Another report, this one by the Army, is due out tomorrow, and it's expected to focus on low-level military responsibility. So horrifying photos, videos, a stream of memos, they're all part of the growing pile of evidence that has been trickling out. But what will be done with it remains to be seen. Tonight on Point, responsibility and accountability for torture at Abu Ghraib prison. Where do you place the blame for what went wrong at Abu Ghraib? How high up the chain of command does accountability go? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
I'm not sure I understand what it means when Schlesinger says that people at the top should take indirect responsibility.
Well, I've been covering this story from day one, and frankly, I'm not sure what that means either. We had heard some time ago that this was likely to be the conclusion. We know there was pretty serious infighting, contention inside this panel. Schlesinger, of course, has been a defense secretary during Republican administrations. Harold Brown, another key member, was defense secretary under Jimmy Carter, and he's a Democrat. And so there was a lot of battling over who should really take responsibility in a direct sense. And I think what you have here is essentially a compromise. They are blaming the commanders on the ground for not supervising their charges. But at the same time, if you read the report, there is time and again a lot of finger-pointing at the unclear directions, at the lack of resources, the lack of troops, the lack of training. And all of these problems go back to Donald Rumsfeld himself, the defense secretary, and his senior leadership at the Pentagon. After all, they were responsible for conducting the war on terror. So it's a little puzzling why, how on one hand the report can sort of point to all of these specific problems about lack of personnel, troops, and training, and at the same time say that the senior guys back in Washington only have indirect responsibility.
Well, I'm wondering, if you don't actually name names, are you really holding people responsible?
Well, you're not. And I mean, another source of contention here, intention in this report, is that this panel was appointed by Rumsfeld himself. Each of the members of the panel are, in fact, members of Rumsfeld's own Defense Policy Board, which is an advisory board that he convenes. And so there were very real and legitimate questions about how independent they would actually be and how tough they would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that even this report is a bit of a surprise to Rumsfeld and people at the Pentagon, because if you look at what Rumsfeld asked them to do, the charter that he directed them, which is in the appendix of this report, he only asked for their quote-unquote professional advice. He did not want them to assign responsibility. So they go a little distance in doing that, but they don't really name too many names.
Well, let's take a step back here, Michael, and look at the bigger picture. Can you bring us up to date about what we know about what went on at Abu Ghraib thus far?
Well, I think it's important to put this in perspective because you do hear, you know, a lot of Americans saying, you know, why do we care about this? I mean, after all, these are bad guys, right? The essential tragedy of the story, the essential point about why this story became a big story, was not just those photos, which horrified everyone, but as Schlesinger pointed out in his remarks at the top of your program, these could be seen in some ways as sort of sadistic fraternity house type pranks, you know. This was not fingernail pulling type torture. These were abusive, but you know, but after all, they're, you know, we have to be important. We have to be precise in defining what torture is. I think the problem here is that what became, you know, what was a war on terror against specific bad guys, Al-Qaeda guys, in which there were debates about how to handle these guys, how to get information from them, became in Iraq through poor policy and poor policy direction a sort of indiscriminate rounding up of everybody. And one of the things that the report makes clear is that there simply was not, you know, any good direction from the administration about who's bad and who's not. I mean, are you going to treat all Iraqis essentially as Al-Qaeda guys? To a certain extent, that happened. And so, you know, in answer to some of the criticism, why are we making a big deal about this? I think it's a big deal because the reason there were so many abuses was that basically the administration, the Pentagon, and senior commanders did not do a good job of saying, okay, you know, we're gonna deal with a handful of Al-Qaeda guys in one way, and we're gonna deal with Iraqis in another way that we round up during the Operation Iraqi Freedom. And and so that's the sort of ongoing theme here, that that what became a very focused policy just got completely out of control and indiscriminate.
Oh, and made up on the ground, it sounds like.
Right.
Now, there's another report due tomorrow, this one by the Army. Are you expecting it to be any more specific in terms of who should be held accountable?
Yes. This one will be more specific, but, and this is the key point, only up to a certain level.
Mm.
This has been a controversial report. It was originally run by a Major General Fay, and then he delivered a draft report a month and a half ago or so that was deemed to be insufficient. And one of the criticisms that came out was that, according to Army regulations, if you are, say, a two-star general, a major general, you can't go beyond your rank in implicating anyone in an investigation you might do. And, of course, one of the problems that emerged from the Abu Ghraib scandal was that it became clear that people right on up to the senior commander in the Iraqi theater, Lieutenant General Sanchez, Ricardo Sanchez, might have been culpable at Abu Ghraib. And so that report was kind of it was rejiggered, and they put a new, more senior general in charge of it. And so the report, which was intended to look mainly at military intelligence, will name some names, as I understand it, including some military intelligence officers up to the colonel level whose careers are essentially over now.
Yeah.
And who may indeed be prosecuted. And I believe it will also cite Sanchez, as does this current Schlesinger report.
Prosecuted on what grounds, Michael? Dereliction of duty?
I think that that is not entirely clear. And one of the reasons why we haven't had any prosecutions above the sort of MP level, the people, the soldiers at Abu Ghraib in cell block 1A, is that it's not clear what they would be court-martialed for. But dereliction of duty would certainly be one thing. We have heard testimony already in some of the courts-martial underway. in Iraq that commander is up to the level of Colonel Thomas Pappas, who is the military intelligence commander in charge of Abu Ghraib, specifically authorized rougher interrogation methods that were in violation of Geneva. And so they could certainly be prosecuted on those, on war crimes-type grounds as well.
Well, speaking of the Geneva Convention, was there any evidence turned up that the Pentagon instructed the military specifically to abide by the Geneva Conventions at Abu Ghraib?
Well, that's one of the key conclusions of the Schlesinger Report that came out today. Is that even though the administration said about the Iraq war, this is going to be conducted in observance of the Geneva Conventions. You remember there was a debate about how to handle the Taliban and al-Qaeda that were found in Afghanistan. It was determined that the Taliban and al-Qaeda should not be treated as prisoners of war in conformance with Geneva. Well, that was not the case with Iraq. In the case of Iraq, this was entirely under the umbrella of the Geneva Convention protections. And as the report notes, Sanchez and others took it upon themselves to decide that some of the detainees they were putting in Abu Ghraib and other prisons were, quote-unquote, unlawful combatants. There was never any written authorization from the Bush administration, from Donald Rumsfeld or anyone else to do that, as far as we know. And that's one of the reasons why Sanchez is culpable and why his career in the military is very probably over right now.
I want to bring in another guest here. Lawrence Korb is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan. Larry, hello.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Do you think the Pentagon and the Army in this case are even capable of investigating themselves?
Well, I think Michael made a terrific point. I mean, this was an in-house group. They're all members of the Defense Policy Board. It would have been good, I think, to have somebody from the Red Cross, for example, or Human Rights Watch on this to provide another perspective. I think Michael was also correct in that I think Jim Schlesinger went beyond the charter that Don Rumsfeld gave him and did, you know, this term about indirectly responsible basically says that, you know, you didn't do your job correctly and you weren't as attentive as you should have been. And had you been, this situation might not have happened.
How serious is that, though? I mean, does that directly call on Rumsfeld to take some sort of action, or can he afford to ignore it?
Well, I think the main question is going to be, should the president take some action against Rumsfeld?
Right. Okay.
I think that's really the issue. The Senate Armed Services Committee next month is going to hold hearings on this report as well as the other one that's being done, the Jones-Fay report, which is being done by the Army to see what happens next. My guess is if, as a result of those hearings, pressure is put on Rumsfeld, you might see the president do something, though I doubt that anything will happen before the election.
Are hearings going to do it, though, do you think, Lawrence? I mean, there's been some talk also about just a full-scale congressional inquiry and investigation.
Well, I think the hearings, again, will raise a spotlight on what happened because it will give senators a chance to probe Jim Schlesinger and Harold Brown if they both go up, as well as the general, and to push them to maybe say some of the things that they didn't in the report. But I think you're right. Unless you have a full scale investigation by an outside group like a 9/11 type of a commission, I don't think much is going to happen at all.
Now, one of the things I'm wondering too is that it was awfully hard for those seven low ranking soldiers to hide, given what was on computers and the photos that they found and whatnot. There doesn't seem to be at this point, anyway, any kind of a paper trail or anything higher up that would lead to responsibility for not enforcing rules on interrogations and whatnot.
No, there isn't. But I think Schlesinger, to his credit, pointed out the fact that Rumsfeld in December of 2002 did issue guidance to the services about Guantanamo that he eventually had to rescind in April 2003, or rescind some of them, and that created some uncertainty. And Rumsfeld, and one of the things that jumped out at me in reading the report is this all goes back to their failure to plan for the post-major combat phase of the war. And I think that, you know, Rumsfeld had access to all of the studies and things done by the State Department, which showed how, you know, bad things could be, and they just ignored those. In fact, they refused to let General Gardner, who was the first person in charge of the post war phase there have access to a lot of the State Department people.
Hold that thought, Larry. We'll pick this up in a moment. We're just going to pause. We're talking tonight about responsibility and accountability for torture at Abu Ghraib. A new report today points to a failure of leadership in the Pentagon. Do you trust the Pentagon to investigate itself, or should there be an independent inquiry? Is it time for a congressional investigation of Abu Ghraib? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about accountability for Abu Ghraib. A new report says there were leadership failures at the Pentagon. Where do you place the blame for what went wrong at the prison? Is it time for a congressional investigation? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine, and by Larry Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and former Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan. And I'd like to bring into the conversation Reed Brody. He's joining me from Brooklyn, New York. He's serving as special counsel for Human Rights Watch, and he's author of the report The Road to Abu Ghraib. Welcome, Reed Brody.
Good evening.
What do you think of today's report that there were leadership failures in Washington? Is it your contention that the Pentagon was negligent or actually responsible for what went on?
Well, I think that's exactly the question. The report talks about management and leadership failures when it should be talking about policy failures. The report seems to go out of its way not to find a relationship between Secretary Rumsfeld's approval of interrogation tactics, which were designed to inflict pain and humiliation, with the infliction of pain and humiliation, not only in Abu Ghraib, and this report was not only supposed to be about Abu Ghraib, but also throughout Iraq and Afghanistan and to some degree in Guantanamo.
In Cuba as well. Well, on what are you basing the fact that Donald Rumsfeld basically green-lighted what went on at the prison?
No, and he didn't greenlight what went on at the prison, and I think that the report and Schlesinger's introduction set up a straw man when they say, look, nobody approved human pyramids. Obviously, nobody approved human pyramids. But we know, and it's been in the public record now for some time, that the Secretary of Defense approved interrogation tactics such as the use of guard dogs to instill fear in prisoners, the use of forced nudity, the use of stress positions, which violate the Geneva Conventions. And what the report seems to say, or what Schlesinger seems to say, is that that's okay. It's okay to approve a policy of using guard dogs, but when there are pictures of guard dogs actually instilling fear in prisoners, that's chaos. That's animal house. And I think there's a failure to connect the policy with the results.
Larry Korb, you've seen the Pentagon at work close up. How does this work? Is it enough simply for the Defense Secretary to set a tone, and then that can be interpreted or misinterpreted at the ground level?
Well, I think it's very critical, the tone that the Secretary and the President set. And I think, you know, this whole thing started when we went into Afghanistan and said that those people captured there would not be treated under the Geneva Convention. I think had we said that right from the beginning, this probably wouldn't have happened. And then I think the point that was just made about Rumsfeld did approve extra, you know, techniques that were not in Geneva, were not in the Army's field manual, and then of course, he did not ensure that there was sufficient monitoring to make sure that these didn't get out of hand. I mean, after all, if you have a prison which the military police was one military policeman for every 75 detainees, and you don't take action to deal with that situation, even if you haven't set the wrong tone, they're liable to be problems.
Reed Brody, back to you. What would you like to see happen in response to the scandal at the prison? What would satisfy you?
You know, I'd like to see what we ask every other country to do when there's this kind of widespread abuse, which is conduct an independent investigation and hold responsible not just those people who were in the pictures or those lower-ranking people, but everybody up the chain of command, up to, if necessary, the Secretary of Defense, who ordered, who approved, who tolerated this kind of behavior.
Michael Hirsch, I'd like to bring you back in there. Is there any evidence in the report that the report talks about that says that people in the Pentagon knew what was going on at Abu Ghraib?
No, I mean, I think the report basically concludes that there is no evidence anyone knew of the specific abuses. There is, you talk about a paper trail or any kind of a trail leading back to the senior levels. I mean, a lot of these guys do have plausible deniability right up to the president. The president said that he wanted to see the Geneva Conventions, at least their strictures or ethics applied to captives, and then kind of left the issue there. Rumsfeld, the only known or the last known order issued by him was in April 16th, 2003, about Guantanamo Bay when he approved certain techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's no, to our knowledge, there's no paper trail from him or other senior members saying, well, this is what we're going to do in Iraq, which is one of the reasons General Sanchez has been left out hanging out to dry here, because he himself approved methods in Iraq, and again, we don't have the paper trail yet leading back. Doesn't say it doesn't exist, but so there are large gaps, lacuna, throughout all of these investigations, and I think it does go back to the bottom line of many critics. Like Reed Brody, where the conclusion is, shouldn't there be a more independent, exhaustive investigation?
Right.
That may only occur, I believe, if it occurs at all in the fall when the Senate Armed Services Committee takes this up. But since it's Republican-controlled, I tend to doubt that that's going to be very exhaustive either.
Reed Brody, Michael was just talking there about gaps in the investigation. Is there anything at Human Rights Watch that you've been able to do to fill in some of those gaps on what went on at Abu Ghraib?
Well, we've been, seeking access to these different memoranda, many of which are still secret. I mean, even with this report, we still don't know exactly which tactics were approved by General Sanchez. We still don't know that whole chain of. I mean, we know that the worst abuses in Abu Ghraib occurred in middle of last year when Donald Rumsfeld and others, and many others, were frustrated that the United States was not finding weapons of mass destruction, was not finding Saddam Hussein, and the insurgency was growing. And there was a decision to kind of ratchet up the interrogations in order to obtain actionable intelligence. And
mm-hmm.
so General Miller was sent over from Guantanamo. We still don't know exactly how all that happened. We don't know what Miller said. We don't know what was said to Miller. And there's a real, I think, a real failure to look at all of those to connect all those dots.
A failure so far. Reed Brody, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Reed Brody is special counsel to Human Rights Watch and author of the report The Road to Abu Ghraib. He spoke with me tonight from New York. I'd like to bring some of our callers in on the conversation this evening. Dan from Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's already been stated that the independence of a panel, which is appointed by the very official whose responsibility for this should be considered, is a bit dubious. I would just like to add that Schlesinger loses a great deal of credibility when he ventures opinions well beyond the purview of his assignment by suggesting quite unambiguously that Rumsfeld should not be expected to resign and that his resignation would be especially regretful. I think he said it would be a win for our enemies.
And
while his assessment of that question is certainly defensible, it's wholly inappropriate that he offer that opinion in the capacity of commissioner of this panel. And I would remind us all that the abuse at Abu Ghraib is not only egregious instances of individual abuse. It was a very terrible strategic blunder from which we are going to suffer for an indefinite period of time.
It certainly didn't do America's reputation in Iraq any good. Dan, as a question to you, what would satisfy you as a way to get to the bottom of what happened at the prison?
I will not be satisfied until a truly independent panel investigates this wholeheartedly, and I'd have no confidence that while this administration is in office, it will divest its own interests It will divest itself from its own interests in order to really pursue a sincere investigation of this.
Michael Hirsch, if I can turn to you with that, where do you think this is going in the fall? I mean, I know we have the hearings with the Senate Intelligence Committee, but anything beyond that, do you think, or are we waiting for pressure or lack thereof?
Well, I think the most significant thing beyond that is November 2nd. this is an administration that, for whatever reason, does not sign responsibility to senior members. I mean, you've got to remember that the Abu Ghraib abuses and other abuses similar to this that were investigated by these commissions were just part of a broader picture of a real series of screw-ups in post-war Iraq. I mean, as has been noted, the administration did not plan for post-war Iraq, as this report says. I think one of the interesting conclusions, if you read between the lines here, is that this is another version of the criticism that's been launched against Rumsfeld on other scores, which is that he simply didn't put enough troops down to run the occupation well, where he simply had things get out of control right from day one, right after Bush declared major combat to be over.
That has been the complaint, right? That one of the things that happened here in terms of oversight with the prisons was that people were awfully busy elsewhere with insurgents they hadn't planned for.
No question. Weapons caches were not secure. You didn't have anything close to the kind of a guard-to-detainee ratio you needed. You had a huge influx of detainees. They didn't know what to do with them. I mean, these are all reasons why you simply cannot blame this on those hapless and, in some cases, depraved MPs at Abu Ghraib. So I think the question becomes, is anyone going to take responsibility for this series of major policy errors that have cost us our reputation to some degree, and that have led to something of a quagmire, I think, in Iraq. It's simply not going to happen. I mean, I think this administration is going into November 2nd saying, look, we're doing things as well as can be expected, and so what you're going to see is either nobody loses a job or everyone loses a job, starting with the president,
depending on the outcome of the vote. I want to bring in Wall Street Journal columnist Dorothy Rabinowitz from New York. She's a member of the Journal's editorial board, and she won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary in 2001. Dorothy, good evening.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Do you think that the Pentagon is responsible for what went on at Abu Ghraib?
No, I don't. But would you mind telling me to whom do I have the honor of listening?
My name is Jennifer Westaway, and you were just listening to Michael Hirsch. He's a senior editor at Newsweek.
Gotcha. Thanks very much. No, the answer is no, I don't. I am always stunned, and I shouldn't be by now, at the notion that a poor handful of MPs shouldn't be held responsible. I think this accords them very little respect. They ought to be responsible, and they are. I certainly think even the most elementary educated young MPs, even in crowded conditions, know that there's something primitive and brutal and sadistic about piling naked prisoners in pyramids, forcing them into simulated sexual activity. I mean, can we really argue that they have no connection with this morally? That is the view. I mean,
is it wasn't just them, that they should take responsibility, others?
Well, let us look at it this way. The moment the story broke, the alacrity with which most people in the media who were not exactly friendly to the administration ran to place blame on the highest officials, exempting all of these, this handful of young men. What did they know?
Excuse me, Jennifer, what did these poor kids know?
Michael, you'd like to get in on this.
Well, I just think this is just such a flagrant misrepresentation of what's been happening to those of us who've been working on this story from the very start. I mean, it's just ridiculous. First of all, no one exonerates the seven MPs, although, of course, not all of them. A couple of them have pled guilty, but their trials are still ongoing. No one is exonerating them of responsibility. That's never been the suggestion. It's never been said by anyone. So I don't know what she's talking about. The second point is this has nothing to do with media being friendly or unfriendly to the administration. This has to do with a series of investigative reports that we and others in the media have done, where we've uncovered memos, we've uncovered testimony, we've heard from numerous sources who have been unhappy with some of the policies of this administration. All of our reporting over the past few months reflects that. It has absolutely nothing to do with politics and everything to do with reporting the facts of this case.
Well, it depends on what you call reporting, as far as I could tell.
What I call reporting is finding out what happened at the genesis of policies that led to certain interrogation practices that are in black and white, and which this current report of this bipartisan panel concludes were attributable to the Pentagon.
Okay, yeah. Michael, let's give Dorothy a chance to respond. Dorothy, go ahead.
It appears to me that when you are faced with the picture of quotes, I can quote you from the Times editorial, and that's not the only one, which is, "Far be it from us to imagine that these young people could have dared to take these steps." That was the issue, that they could never have dared to do this without some sort of agreement, some sort of obedience to higher authority implicit in the air and in the atmosphere. All of this is well and good. No one can deny that there was laxity. No one can deny the absence of supervision. This stands to reason. It could not have happened if they'd been supervised. But that isn't the point. The point is the rush to judgment, to blame the very highest level of government for this. It's the focus. You would think that we had not lived in a society that had not seen the most vicious kind of brutality in hazing. Is this a society that has never before heard of mob violence, mob brutality?
And what people are capable of. My question to you, though, Dorothy, is even the reports that the Army and the military itself are bringing out now, though, are now saying that, yes.
And who would deny that these people should have been carefully looked after? But I have to say that my own knowledge of this report is that no one is saying that the administration is responsible and that Donald Rumsfeld is responsible. You see, it's the large wish to tar everyone with this brush. And what happens is the complete absence. It's like a footnote. Who are these young people who did this?
I don't think anyone's trying to deflect blame from the soldiers involved. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that is what emerges from this picture.
That's the result, if not the intent.
Yes, it's not the intention, but it is what
This
emerges.
Is Larry Korb. I'd like to read something from the report. It says, "The abuses were not just the failure of some individuals to follow known standards, and they are more than the failure of a few leaders to enforce proper discipline. This is Schlesinger. There is both institutional and personal responsibility at higher levels."
At higher levels. Right.
What high levels are we talking about?
Well, I wish we knew.
Well,
then if you go on in the report, he talks about Rumsfeld sending out a memo that he had to retract. Schlesinger also talks about the fact that the joint staff, which is part of the chairman's office, did not exercise their responsibility to make sure there were enough people there to do what needed to be done. And implicit in this, and in fact it says several times, it all goes back to the failure of the administration to plan adequately for the post-major combat phase. They were over-optimistic.
Larry, hold that thought. Larry and Michael, stay with me. We're just going to take a short break here. Dorothy, I know you're on deadline. Thank you for taking some time to join us tonight. Dorothy Rabinowitz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning Wall Street Journal columnist. She spoke with me from New York. We're discussing tonight responsibility and accountability for torture at Abu Ghraib. Where do you place the blame for what went wrong? How high up the chain of command does accountability go? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jennifer Westaway. You're listening to On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about responsibility and accountability for torture at Abu Ghraib. A new report today points to a failure of leadership in the Pentagon. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine, and by Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and former Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan. I'd like to bring another caller into the discussion from Cleveland, Ohio. Paul, you're on point.
Thank you. I feel that this is a very general approach from the top on down. In other words, let's take Bush is responsible. Cheney is the operational person. Ashcroft and Rumsfeld pushed the envelope on treatment of detainees or prisoners from the beginning, as far as they could push it. We don't have prisoners of war. We have enemy combatants, but we have a war president, and we are at war. But we don't have prisoners of war, and all these things were attempted and pushed from the beginning. And then Cheney and Rumsfeld has to know that General Jeffries is transferred from Cuba to Iraq in the summer of last year or fall, and the interrogators need softening up all of a sudden from the MPs of the prisoners, and this is all out in the open. And
that timing was more than coincidental in your mind.
Well, absolutely. Coincidental was impossible. And, so what I'm getting at is these people were, this is a tight-lipped, highly secretive administration. Now, they don't know that that Jeffries is being transferred and why. And Sanchez, when Sanchez finds out the photos are out, General Myers doesn't find out immediately in January that the photos are out. And then Rumsfeld and Cheney don't know. And then Rumsfeld was blindsided in what month was it, about June, or when the scandal broke, by the photos.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
you don't believe it.
Well, you can't believe it. It's there. I mean, these generals are not going to keep. I mean, if they keep this thing quiet from Cheney and Rumsfeld, that's terrible. They couldn't possibly get away with that.
What do you think happened? Where do your sympathies lie?
I just said there was a general approach for interrogation and getting away with the mistreatment, if you want to call it that, but the pressure on prisoners from the very beginning. And this is just the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
How much can we get away with? How much can we bend the rules or Constitution or Geneva Convention or whatever? And as you say, there's one time somebody put it in writing. Rumsfeld tried to put it in writing, and unfortunately for us, we know that happened. And unfortunately for him, he had to back off.
Thank you, Paul. Larry Korb, if I can turn to you for a moment, can we talk about culture at the Pentagon?
Well, I think it's very important. Don Rumsfeld claims that he is in total control. I mean, if you look at the way he handles the briefings, for example, as compared to where Dick Cheney did when he was Secretary of Defense in the first Persian Gulf War, I mean, he is a micromanager. He's into everything, and then all of a sudden, they want us to believe that he didn't know that this was going on. I think that's somewhat, contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at his management style and you look at the way he has handled this. And remember, everybody is focusing on those horrible pictures. But Schlesinger points out that it wasn't just they didn't photograph everything. There were a lot of other things that happened that weren't photographed. And that's really, I think, is important to keep in mind because, yes, these photographs were taken. They've been used as evidence. But these people did not think that they would be caught in any way. They basically indicted themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And there were things that occurred not only at Abu Ghraib, but in Afghanistan and Guantanamo. The Schlesinger report says there have been 300 allegations of abuse and 66 substantiated cases so far.
Back to the phones here. Matt is calling from Uxbridge, Massachusetts. Matt, you're a West Point graduate.
Yes, I am, Jennifer.
And what do you make of this?
First of all, I just want to clarify, I have not read the report, but I have paid close attention to what's being said on the radio. First of all, from day one, when I was indoctrinated at West Point, we are taught to follow the Geneva Convention, that the United States has to have the moral high road in anything that we get involved with around the world, simply because of our stature. And to talk about quickly, soldiers, the soldiers should have known better, because they should have received training before they had even been deployed. They should have been trained and retrained, so there's an inherent problem there. Second of all, the soldiers and the officers had to have had rules of engagement given to them before they got in country.
Why do you think that would have led to the kind of stuff we saw at Abu Ghraib?
Okay, rules of engagement, knowing who to be able to fire at, when to fire your weapon, what you do to react to not only to preserve your own life, but also those fellow soldiers around you or civilians, those are given to you before you even leave this country,
mm-hmm.
okay? Which leads me to believe that these people had to know what their bounds were in terms of the interrogation. That's why, and those rules of engagement not only come from the Pentagon, but they come from the United States State Department, because I can remember being deployed to Egypt, and we had rules of engagement.
Yeah.
They were very informal. It was a peacetime training exercise, but we were told what to do in case we were attacked.
Right.
Bodyguards, and this was over 10 years ago.
Can I just speak to that?
Yes, please. Michael, is that
well,
you?
I think the caller makes an excellent point, and one of the problems here was that there were not clear rules of engagement set by the military or anyone else. One of the ongoing themes, for example, is that Field Manual 3452, which is the basic Army doctrine on interrogations, was either ignored, evaded. There was an earlier version of it that was cited rather than a later version in 92. There was all sorts of confusion about rules of engagement. And, in fact, one of the problems that we had in Iraq and still have to this day is we're not quite sure who the enemy is.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, you had, as I said earlier, a situation where General Sanchez, the commander of JTF-7, was ordering that some the combatants be treated as unlawful combatants, even though the president himself had said that the Iraq war would be dealt with under Geneva. So there was a great deal of confusion over precisely what the rules of engagement were against an enemy that was undefined. I'm talking about the post-war combat situation, the insurgency
right.
situation.
Right.
And we still, to this day, don't have a good grasp of.
I'd like to see if we can squeeze in one more caller here. This is from Westwood, Massachusetts. Mudafa, have I pronounced your name correctly?
Yes, ma'am. How are you?
I'm well. I understand that you're an Iraqi and an American citizen.
Yes, ma'am, I am.
And what's your view of what went on at Abu Ghraib?
I mean, it's really odd having discussion of what's happened in Abu Ghraib and not even having a discussion of what's happening now. I mean, just last week, an uprising happened in Abu Ghraib prison, resulted in the death of two prisoners. And so...
There were riots, right.
Yeah, so the problem is not something you investigate. I mean, it's not an event happened and that's it, to change, follow. No, there's still the same policy, and I do agree that the problem should go to the higher command. And Rumsfeld himself is a man who believed just in himself and the way he defined humanity or torture or whatever. So this fascist way of thinking by Rumsfeld and his group is resulting in an insult to the Iraqis and the American value. And it should be stopped, and the media should take on him if they really feel loyalty to the American Constitution or American value of living and respecting a human dignity.
This must be a topic of some discussion within the Iraqi community in the United States. Do you want to see a congressional inquiry?
Oh, definitely. This is a major problem. I mean, the problem is it's not done. It's still the same. There's still the same disrespect, degrade to human dignity in Iraq, disregard to human life, even use of excessive force like bombing by aircraft cities which could collapse. I mean... So it's the policy is getting worse. It's not didn't stop, and it's not getting corrected. And this is like you're making it worse. You're creating the enemy. I mean, Rumsfeld is creating the enemy.
Mudafa, thank you for joining us this evening. Larry and Michael, I'd like to thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
It was a really interesting discussion, and we'll see what happens. We have possibly another report tomorrow. Have I got that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lawrence Korb is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and former Assistant Secretary of Defense. And Michael Hirsch is a senior editor at Newsweek magazine. You can continue the conversation online by going to onpointradio.org and then click on forums. In a moment, we're going to have Vice President Dick Cheney explain his view on gay marriage, a bit of tape from a speech by him earlier today. I'm Jennifer Westaway. You're listening to On Point. Vice President Dick Cheney was on the campaign trail today, answering a question at a town hall meeting in Davenport, Iowa. Cheney explained his view on same-sex marriage, a topic that's seen as one of the key wedge issues of the 2004 election. Freedom means freedom for everybody, Cheney said, adding that laws on same-sex marriages should be left up to the states. He took the same view in 2000, but it now puts him at odds with President Bush, who has called for a constitutional amendment defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman. Cheney's daughter Mary is gay. Here's an excerpt from the vice president's remarks today in Iowa.
With respect to the question of gay marriage, Lynn and I have a gay daughter. So it's an issue that our family is very familiar with. We have two daughters, and we have enormous pride in both of them. They're both fine young women. They do a superb job, frankly, of supporting us, and we were blessed with both our daughters. With respect to the question of relationships, my general view is that freedom means freedom for everyone. People ought to be free to enter into any kind of relationship they want to. The question that comes up with respect to the issue of marriage is what kind of official sanction or approval is going to be granted by government to particular relationships. Historically, that's been a relationship that's been handled by the states. States have made that basic fundamental decision in terms of defining what constitutes a marriage. I made clear 4 years ago when I ran, and this question came up in the debate I had with Joe Lieberman, that my view was that that's appropriately a matter for the states to decide, that that's how it ought to best be handled. The president has, as a result of the decisions that have been made in Massachusetts this year by judges, felt that he wanted to support a constitutional amendment to define, at the federal level, to define what constitutes marriage. That I think his perception was that the courts, in effect, were beginning to change without allowing the people to be involved, without there being part of the political process, that the courts, in that particular case, the state court in Massachusetts, were making the judgment or the decision for the entire country, and he disagreed with that. So where we're at this point is he has come out in support of a federal constitutional amendment, and I don't think, so far it hasn't had the votes to pass. Most states have addressed this. There is on the books the federal statute, Defense of Marriage Act, passed in 1996, and to date, it has not been successfully challenged in the courts, and it may be sufficient to resolve the issue. But at this point, say my own preference is as I've stated, but the president makes basic policy for the administration, and he's made it clear that he does, in fact, support a constitutional amendment on this issue.
Vice President Dick Cheney on the campaign trail today in Davenport, Iowa. Special thanks to Guyana Tarosyan, reporter at WSUI in Iowa City, Iowa. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Rachel Dornhelm, Michael Garth, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.